ourselves that we saved Joey Selden one more time, that we were good men. Well, that don't make a good man, damn it. He grabbed his jacket from the back of his chair. I'll tell Joey he's got to close at 9:10. He leaned his long body right at Kreller and he smiled. And I'll tell him tomorrow morning a crew'll be up there to fix the place up. And God help you, Kreller, if you vote no.
Is that a threat?
Kreller gasped, his puffy face white with shock.
Yep,
Sonny said as he zipped up his nylon windbreaker.
And carrying it out'll be a real pleasure, too.
He grinned. As Sonny drove toward the park, he was struck by the clarity of the stars over the black mountaintops and the sharp, dark outlines of roofs, and he could hear warm voices through the lit-up windows, and he felt strong, and he felt clean, and for the first time in weeks he could think, and he knew he could take care of everyone. He would take care of his town again. He had never stopped being a good man. Until now, he just hadn't been good enough. Joey chuckled when Sonny finished talking.
Cite me the law that says I have to close at 9:10, Sonny.
Just do it, Joey. Don't make problems,
Sonny said. Joey tilted his head toward the park and smiled.
Tell you what, Sonny. The minute I hear the curfew blow, I'll start closing up.
Sonny unpeeled a stick of gum.
It's almost 9:10 now, Joey. Can I give you a lift home?
No, thanks, Joey said. I like the walk. And besides, takes me a while to close up.
Even as Alice knocked on the stoner's door, she knew she shouldn't have come. But Lester had called back to apologize to her mother, who then insisted she take the phone. In a low, rambling voice, Lester had whispered how lonely he was, how unfair God was, how it was all his father's fault, that he and his father had just had a terrible fight, that there was too much pressure on him, that everyone expected too much of him, that he'd be better off dead. Please come, he'd begged, please. When he opened the door, she was shocked at how pale and drawn he was. His skin had erupted in sore red pimples. He needed a haircut, and his clothes were soiled and wrinkled as if he'd slept in them. Every time she said anything, he would blink. They were upstairs watching television with Mrs. Stoner in her bedroom. Lester had made a large bowl of popcorn. He had arranged two chairs next to his mother's bed, but it was soon apparent that Mrs. Stoner, in her medicated drift, had already forgotten Alice was there. At first, Lester did all the talking, his incessant, almost giddy chatter, gossipy and desperate to amuse her, to hold her interest, to keep her here, as if he feared that in a moment's lull he might lose her. Everything he knew seemed to have come over the police radio, automobile accidents and domestic violence, and now the details of a prowler who had been in the alley the other night behind Hammy's Bar and Grill.
And Vic Crowley said he heard the guy running down the alley, but when he got on the street, the guy was gone. There was no one there.
Lester's eyes shone.
It was just like the night had swallowed him up. Vic wanted to pick that creep Mooney up for questioning, but my father said no. There hadn't been any crime committed. You know how all the tires were flat out at the lake that night? Well, I told my father it had to be Mooney. I told him I'd swear to it, even in court I was so sure. And he said, but just because he was there doesn't mean he did it. He said, because if that's the way it works, then you were out there too, don't forget. Can you believe it?
Lester said.
Can you believe my own father said that?
He laughed, shaking his head.
About me, his own son.
He seemed dazed, out of step, like a first-time traveler to a treacherous land. She stiffened against the hard-back chair. Mrs. Stoner's chalky face turned on the stained pillow. She had been drooling.
What time is it?
8:45, said Lester.
Is Daddy home yet?
She asked.
No, Mother, answered Lester.
Mrs. Stoner's eyes had closed again.
He's so busy,
she sighed.
What is it tonight?
Council meeting, or so he said, Lester added.
Poor man,
she sighed again, then laughed weakly.
Lord knows there's not much to come to here anymore, is there?
Alice stared at the television so as not to see the crooked nylon wig. All the patterns had been wrenched, the bright rugs smelled of damp and dust. In the bathroom, mildew had invaded the grout, and red towels hung over orange towels. The plants on the windowsill were spindly and yellowing. It was hot in the bedroom, and the vase of red gladioli on Mrs. Stoner's nightstand kept making Alice sneeze. She wiped her nose and watched the suntan lotion ad that was on television. It showed a girl strolling down a beach past three guys who jumped up from their blankets and followed her. She envied Mary Agnes, who must be having so much fun at the lake. She should have gone, should have done what she wanted instead of what everyone else wanted. Good little Alice, who always did what her mother said. Poor little Alice, afraid to say yes, afraid to say no. She felt like everyone's wailing wall. If the Clue Box dog dumped under the clothesline and her mother stepped in it, it was Alice's fault, because if she hadn't been lazy-assing out in the backyard all day, the goddamn dog wouldn't have come over in the first place. Even the reasons for Omar Duval's continued absence had become so convoluted in her mother's reasoning that she was to blame. Because so much money was needed to send Alice to college, her mother was being deprived of the opportunity of a lifetime. She made little sense lately. It was getting so bad that Alice had almost begun to prefer being the butt of Anthology Carper's sick jokes to spending a night at home.
"Want some more?" Lester whispered, passing her the popcorn bowl.
She shook her head and tried to see what time it was. Lester caught her looking at the clock, and he checked his mother to see if she had fallen asleep yet. Her eyes were closed, and her breathing verged on snoring. With a nod toward the door, he started out of the chair. Before Alice could get the tissue to her nose, she sneezed. Mrs. Stoner's eyes opened wide.
"Bless you,"
came her drugged, gluey voice.
"You're catching cold."
Lester made a face as if she'd sneezed on purpose. He stared at the television, annoyed that his mother was awake.
"I think I am," Alice said, getting up. "Maybe I'd better go, Les. I'll call you when—"
"It's these damn flowers," he said, yanking the vase from the bureau.
"Aunt Eunice brought them over,"
Mrs. Stoner sighed as Les swept past, taking the flowers downstairs.
"Poor Eunice. All she did was cry. Do I look that bad?"
Mrs. Stoner laughed. The wig dipped over her left temple like a rakish beret, exposing miserly patches of her own hair, which had once been as soft and wavy as Les's.
"You look fine,"
Alice said, shredding the tissue in her lap. The tumor in Mrs. Stoner's belly swelled against the sheets. There was nothing the doctors could do, nothing anyone could do but wait, wait, wait for death. It was coming, coming. No, it was here, there, rising and falling with her every breath. Les had come back into the room. He bent over his mother and, all in emotion, plumped her pillows, adjusted her wig, and kissed her dry cheek so tenderly that Alice felt her eyes swell with tears. Poor Les. And now, as he scooped the tissue bits from Alice's lap and laid a new one there, his hand lingered on her thigh, and she smiled weakly at him. All the way down to the rec room, she reasoned it out. They were both lonely, so why not see each other once in a while? Only this time, they'd just be friends. This time, she'd be strong.
"See?"
he was saying as he showed her the cord tacked along the stair molding. "I wired the police radio up to my room. I leave it on all night."
"Doesn't Mrs. Miller come any more or less?"
she asked. It hurt to think of him in the dark, listening to police calls all night long.
"That bitch," he said. "I fired her. Now I'm the only nurse."
When they got downstairs, he didn't even turn on the light.
"Oh, Alice,"
he moaned, lying against her on the couch.
"I've missed you so much."
He kissed her frantically, murmuring against her lips.
"I've been going crazy here. I'd write you a poem, and then you wouldn't call me back, and I'd burn it.
Here, here,"
he moaned, pressing her open hand against his bulging fly.
"See, see, see how much I've missed you."
"No, Les,"
she whispered, trying to pull away, but he held it there.
"Let's just be friends,"
she whispered, as he slid his hand inside her shorts. She moaned and lay back, her eyes wide in the darkness. The couch creaked, and Lester was moaning.
"No, no,"
she said, pushing him away.
"No, Les,"
she sat up.
"It's the same as before," she said. "What you said that time. I was hurt when you said that, but it's true in a way. Things seem all tangled, you know what I mean? Now you're having problems, and we're all mixed up in each other's problems. You see what I mean?"
she asked. She turned on the light then and forced a smile.
"Do you?"
she asked hopefully.
"You've always had a twisted way of looking at things, Alice," he said with a sneer. "If someone's nice to you, you wonder what they want."
"I have to go now,"
she said, getting up. She would not play this game. He chuckled.
I remember how all through school you'd just sit there in the back of the room hoping nobody'd talk to you. Until I started going out with you, you sat in the lunchroom like such a creep, alone every day for 4 years. He laughed. So now you think you're a big deal? Now you've got Mary Agnes and her shitty friends so you don't need me, do you? What do? Go over to the lake all the time? Oh, Alice, he cried, trying to pull her back down. You let me go. You make me sick. You're so damn mean. You're the meanest person I've ever known. And you're the coldest person I've ever known, he growled, clenching her wrist. Stop it, Lester. You let me go, damn it, or you'll be sorry. She couldn't wrench her hand free. He laughed and she froze. What are you going to do, Alice? Start screaming? Help, help. Lester's finally gone off the deep end. He's crazy, 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 crazy. Tears bubbled down his cheeks. Her hand was numb in his hold. If she moved, something would break, would smash into infinitesimal splinters. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Please stay. Please, he panted, nuzzling his wet cheek against hers. He ran his hand up and down her back as if to resuscitate her. Her eyes were on the stairwell. Someone was walking overhead, and now the door at the top of the stairs creaked open.
You down there, Les?
Mr. Stoner called.
Les?
What is it?
Les called back. His eyes darted between her and the stairs.
Got a little surprise up here. Alice there, too?
Mr. Stoner said self-consciously, as if he thought he'd caught them making out.
I'm down here,
she hollered, yanking her wrist from the cuff of Lester's fist. His head trembled and his shoulder twitched as if with a seizure.
Come on up, kids,
Mr. Stoner called with forced heartiness.
We'll have a party. I'll go see if your mother's...
She ran up the stairs where Mr. Stoner stood smiling with two pizza boxes in his arms.
That's what I call hungry.
Alice?
He took a step as she flew past.
What's wrong, Alice?
She didn't even close the door behind her.
Lester! Lester!
Mr. Stoner's voice clung to her all the way home, like the mist of the damp night air. Eunice Bonifant was in the bathroom when the telephone rang. She took another slug of beer and continued rubbing eyeshadow from her left eyelid. The phone kept ringing through the empty house. 10 o'clock. Too early for the breather, and if it was sunny, he could wait, just like the shriveled pork in the oven had waited. The ringing stopped, then started again seconds later. She grabbed her beer can from the toilet tank and scuffed into the living room.
Mrs. Bonifant, this is Carl at the station. Something just happened.
What, Carl? Eunice groaned.
Carl was easily rattled at night.
Mooney was just here. Blue Mooney, him and his whole gang.
Christ, what happened?
Damn Sonny in his soft heart, thinking all Mooney needed was a break for once.
Well, there was a lot of looking around, you know, checking things out, and...
How many were there?
She interrupted.
Three. Yeah, three.
Three? Three what? Carloads?
Three guys.
What'd they do?
They got gas.
Okay, Carl. Let's see now. It's 10 o'clock, and you wake me up from a sound sleep to tell me three guys just bought gas?
She waited.
Did I get that straight?
Well, I just thought you should know,
he said sulkily.
In case anything happens.
Nothing's going to happen, she belched softly. Believe me.
I hope you're right.
I'll tell you what, Carl. Why don't you close up now and...
Thanks, Mrs. Bonifant,
he said, hanging up while she was still talking.
Go home, you little asshole.
Damn him, she thought. Damn Al for leaving her alone like this. Damn Sonny. Damn all men. She went to the refrigerator and took out another can of Sonny's favorite beer. She went into the living room and flopped onto the sofa to watch television. 15 minutes later, she went in for another can.
The hell with it,
she muttered as she stretched over the arm of the couch and dialed. Grinning when she heard Sonny's voice, she began to pant into the mouthpiece.
Hello? Hello? Who's there?
Sonny demanded.
It's me, she giggled.
What is it?
I need you. I need you so bad.
I see.
You can't talk.
That's right.
Oh,
she said, closing her eyes.
You're in Carol's room. Oh, God.
No.
Sonny hedged. Then Lester's there.
That's right,
he said. I miss you, Sonny, she sniffed, and her eyes filled with tears. I had everything ready. I've been waiting.
Oh, well, why don't you call me in the morning, then? There's not much I can do right now. Not without my folder on the case,
he added, clearing his throat.
I wish you were here, Sonny. I'm so lonesome.
For police business, you really should call the station, sir.
It is police business, goddammit. As a matter of fact, Carl just called here all shook up about a carload of creeps that were just at the station, Mooney and his buddies.
Mooney? Not him again.
Yeah, him again, she laughed. Now, maybe you should come up here and get all the details while they're still fresh in my mind.
Is that so?
Sonny cleared his throat again.
Anything happen?
Not yet, baby, but it will when you get here.
Well,
Sonny sighed.
In that case, maybe I better check it out then.
Oh, yeah, you better.
Okay, very good. That's what I'll do.
Pull in the garage and come up through the cellar.
Will do,
Sonny said.
Roger!
She laughed and hung up. Sonny hung up at his end, and then up in her bedroom, so did Carol Stoner. She slipped her hand under the mattress to check her stockpile. She could hear Sonny at the bottom of the stairs.
Probably nothing, he said to Lester, but I wouldn't feel right if I didn't check it out.
After he left, Lester went into his bedroom, and then for the rest of the night, all she could hear was the sputtering static of the police radio. Her husband and her son needed their freedom, but she still didn't have enough pills. Dressed completely in black, Robert Haddad waited in his unlit office, eyes trained on the window of Hammy's Bar and Grill. At midnight, the last patron, an old man with suspenders over his white undershirt, lingered in the doorway, talking animatedly, as little by little Hammy inched the door shut. Haddad stood up now so he could see Hammy, who was behind the bar washing and drying glasses, while he smiled up at the television. With all the lights on, Hammy looked younger and happier in the empty glare, and richer. His unvaried routine never exceeded 23 minutes. After he set all the chairs on the tables, he would sweep the floor, and then he would remove his register drawer and carry it down to the basement, where he'd sit on a wooden Poland Spring box and count his receipts on a round metal garden table. Some of the cash went into a green night deposit bag, which he dropped off at the bank on his way home. But most of it, Haddad knew, was hidden in a padlocked steel box Hammy kept in the base of an unused capped chimney. This he had learned after many patient nights crouched in the swelter of the dark alley, observing the cranky barkeeper through the mesh-covered cellar window. Last Saturday night, Haddad had been ready to execute his plan when Vic Crowley, the cop, hurried into the alley. Haddad had ducked into the wedge of the darkness behind the trash cans. When he heard the zip, then the long, steady drum roll of urine against the cans, he scrambled out and ran, leaving Crowley trapped midstream, calling helplessly over his shoulder,
"Halt! I said halt!"
Tonight, Haddad was ready. He watched the last light go out. He watched Hammy back his red Buick carefully out of the alley, then drive off. Still, Haddad waited. Tonight, there would be no rush. This was the beginning of a brand new life. He was going to straighten it all out. And from this night forward, there would be no more falling behind, no more foolishness. From now on, if he and Astrid didn't have the money, they'd go without. He'd cover the unpaid premiums and set things straight, tonight, with this one act. That this might be wrong, criminal, immoral, was not a consideration, because it was that first step, that fortuitous foothold all successful businessmen needed. And it would be just this one time. It would be the boost he needed. It was in the nature of things. Often, for shrubbery to thrive, it first had to be hacked to the ground. Besides, the whole system was just too unfair, too lopsided, with him having to be accountable for every penny, while Hammy's cash trade was untraceable and virtually tax-free. Life was a network of inequities that had to be realigned, readjusted, made fair for all men, he thought with a surge of conviction. He crossed the street with his new black sneakers springing into the alley. He He knelt down, and with only a few jabs of his long screwdriver into the rotted wood, pried loose the cellar window and lifted it on its hinges. The dead cellar air seemed to suck him in, so quickly did he find himself dropping down, then scrambling through the dark to the chimney. He needed to turn on his flashlight only once to find the latch on the pitted metal clean-out door. As soon as he had the strongbox out of the chimney, he clicked off the light and unfolded the large grocery bag he'd carried in his pocket. Into it, he poured the dollar bills, then returned the strongbox to the chimney, carefully latching the door closed again. It would be 24 hours before Hammy discovered his loss. Haddad lifted himself easily through the window, closed it, then raced back to his office, where, in the dark, he stuffed the bag of cash into his briefcase. He changed into his suit and tie, then started home. Along open stretches of sidewalk, he walked with tight, deliberate steps, but whenever he entered the safe shadows of trees, he ran, at times careening into them, throwing his arms around their rough girth, holding himself there, flattened, his cheek to the bark, like a man caught in a windstorm, holding on for dear life and laughing. It had been a week. At 4 o'clock, Marie called the house from work. Alice answered and said Benji had come home from the pool a while ago and was watching a show. "Were there any calls?" Marie interrupted.
"Just that Father Gannon again. He said he'd call you back."
She cleared her throat. "So it's just the two of you there?" she asked, wincing.
"Just us,"
Alice answered. After she hung up, she resumed her typing, and the minute Astrid left for the ladies' room with her new movie magazine and her cigarettes, she dialed the Mayo sisters' boarding house.
"Hello, I'd like to rent a room,"
she said, pinching her nostrils, her mouth close to the receiver.
"Do you have any available?"
"Well, I don't know. That is, oh dear, I'm not sure,"
sighed May Mayo's sweet flutter.
"It depends. We might. My sister, well, you see, we have to wait until the week is up, and then we'll know, I hope."
Marie closed her eyes.
"So you do have an empty room?"
"Not really. Well, it's empty, you see, but the rent's paid till Sunday."
"Has he moved out? I mean, your tenant?"
"Well, that's hard to say, dearie. The poor man's only got the clothes he wears. I offered him some of the..."
"Thank you,"
Marie said, and hung up quickly as Astrid teetered back into the office on her gold spike heels. The two women avoided each other's eyes. Astrid smoothed her skirt over her hips and sat down. Marie's hands trembled as she rolled a sheet of stationery into the typewriter.
"He's gone," she thought. "Omar's gone."
She still had 6 more letters to do.
"Oh, God, he's gone."
She buried her face in her hands and took a deep breath. She felt like screaming.
"You okay?"
Astrid asked, glancing up from her adding machine.
"Just tired."
She started to type quickly, before any conversation could start. This morning she had turned off Astrid's radio and asked her to please be quiet, and Astrid, offended, hadn't spoken since. The icy silence had been a relief. As she typed now, she could feel Astrid staring at her.
"I'm sorry," Astrid said finally. "I should have thought. I mean, here you are struggling at this shitty job, and I come in blabbing about Bobby's bonus and my new dryer and my new hi-fi."
"It wasn't that," she said coldly, still typing. "I just need quiet when I work."
Today, Astrid wore a white satiny dress with a wide gold cinch belt. Even when she didn't look directly at Astrid, her corner of the cramped little office seemed to glow.
"Like she's dressed for a nightclub,"
Marie thought irritably. With Omar gone, everything got on her nerves, especially this mindless, brash woman who didn't even have to work, whose husband had his own business. Working was just an extension of Astrid's social life, a chance to show off her new clothes, she thought, banging the carriage so hard on every return that the typewriter jumped and now sat crooked on the table.
"I hate quiet and you hate noise," Astrid sighed, staring for a moment, awed by another of life's conundrums.
Marie kept typing. Frowning, she bent closer to the letter, as if Astrid's chatter were obscuring her vision.
"Of course, I don't have kids and all that, so I guess I just got used to my own commotion."
She paused.
"Speaking of which, I hear Sam's locked up."
She looked up, blinking, not certain she'd heard correctly. Astrid smiled.
Must be so nice now, not having that worry hanging over you, you know, of him barging in here or bothering you at night.
Marie started to say something, then closed her mouth. There was nothing she knew to say. Not a word came to mind. These were her troubles, which she had never discussed with anyone, and certainly wasn't about to with this gum-snapping, sleazy showgirl who had obviously lived such a low life herself she considered everyone else's misfortunes public property, like her own. Marie had never understood how women could bare their souls with such ease, exposing themselves so shamelessly to one another. It was a weakness she had always despised. Sometimes the most unsettling legacy of Sam's failure as a husband, father, provider, seemed to be this virginity, this obdurate male soul in female flesh that set her apart from women as well as men. Well, people might find her abrasive, but she'd choose strength and honesty any day over Astrid's perfumed guile and feather-brained duplicity.
"Do him good," Astrid was saying. "One of these days, he might shock the hell out of you and just never take another drink."
She shook her head and smiled.
"They're sweet guys, too, the Lushes. You know they've been there." "Hey!"
Astrid gave a sly wink of her blue-lidded eyes.
"Who's the dreamboat I saw getting out of your car last week? Tall guy, dark hair, hanging over your window like he hated saying goodbye. I saw him, and I said to myself, 'Hey now, Marie, don't fool around.'"
She raised her hands over her head and shimmied in her chair.
"She's got herself a man, you know what I mean?"
Marie jumped up and started for the door. Around her, everything blurred. Hearing Astrid talk about Omar suddenly confirmed her loss, her failure to keep him.
"Oh, Marie!"
Astrid called, hurrying after her and throwing her arms around her.
"Oh, you poor kid. You poor, poor kid,"
she crooned, holding her close, so close that Marie was shocked to feel Astrid's breasts press against her.
"It's not easy, is it?"
Astrid said softly, and Marie shook her head. Astrid patted her back, and she didn't dare move.
"They'll drive you crazy," she whispered. "They will."
She stepped back and held Marie at arm's length, then laughed that quick, hard laugh that set everything back where it had been before. Marie hunched over her typewriter as Astrid's adding machine seemed to keep time to her words.
"Christ, it's hot. You know, I was telling Bobby we should get a place at the lake. Nothing big, just some shacky little cabin type thing. Hey, maybe you and the kids could come out. We could have a big party, starting early in the morning, you know, all day long, a beach party. I could invite all my wire plant friends."
She looked up and sighed.
"Bobby kills me. He's got all this money from this big bonus, and every time I mention, 'Hey, I just thought, you ever need a loan or anything, kid, you just let me know. I mean that.'"
Marie kept her eyes on the letter, her face blank. Hell would freeze over before she ever begged from someone like Astrid Haddad.
"Shit!"
Astrid suddenly cried, sucking the tip of her forefinger, ragged with a broken nail.
"That was my best one."
With the alacrity a bleeding wound required, she opened her huge white purse and from it seized a red leather case containing small, glinting scissors, some curved, some blunt-tipped, and tweezers, and nail files, and tiny bottles of oils and polishes. Marie shivered. The rough drag of the file back and forth over Astrid's nail gave her goosebumps.
"Damn, damn, damn," Astrid muttered with her furious sanding. "I'm so mad I could scream."
There grew now in the deeper woodshade of the fully leafed trees blue gentian and smelly black snake root, upon whose feathery white flowers flies clustered, and vines of young bittersweet that had begun to inch toward him. Around his leg, where the trouser had been torn, the first creeper curled, thin and waxy against his skin. His bloated body strained against his clothes, so dust-darkened now that fabric and flesh seemed one. The hump-backed old dog came daily, usually in the first pale stillness of morning. Watchful, it lay off a few feet on spread haunches, its wet black nose keen to this creature's foul virility. Whatever gives form to humanness, its features, eyes, nose, mouth, and ears, every protrusion and concavity of bone that suggests strength, propulsion, and contraction, these had subsided and were sinking deeper into the gaseous chemistry of death. Perhaps it seemed to the patient dog, its own vermiculate belly rumbling, that something grew here, that in the carious mass a new life was forming. After a while, the old dog's square, blunt head sank onto its front paws, and it emitted a low, imploring growl. Tonight's 4th of July band concert in the park would be the biggest one of the year. Alice had to work, and Norm was going with Weeb Miller. Marie had asked him to take Benji, but he had refused, and then Benji looked so hurt that she had told him she'd go with him. Supper was over, and she was pouring hot chocolate pudding into three handleless teacups and two mismatched bowls. The extra serving was for Omar, should he happen to come. More than a week had passed without a word from him, and so she'd made up her mind. The days of Marie Fermoyle crawling after a man, any man, were over. Besides, today there had been a ray of hope. Mr. Briscoe said he had a friend who ran the cafeterias at UVM, and if Marie wanted, he'd write to him about a job for Alice. If she wanted. She had typed the letter immediately, and then had run it upstairs for his signature. Plus, she kept telling herself, there was always Sam's trust money. Just knowing about it had given her a new sense of calm. Talking to Helen was useless. She would have to get at it through Sam, now that he was sober and healthier. She had even considered driving up to Applegate with the kids this weekend, but then she remembered that nosy priest, that Father Gannon, offering to bring one of them up to see Sam. Maybe she'd send Alice. Sam might listen to his daughter. She glanced at the telephone. Maybe Omar had been in Bennington all this time, looking into that soap business he'd told her about. Maybe he'd lost her telephone number. Or maybe he'd realized the last thing on earth he needed was to be saddled with a desperate woman and her three bickering kids. Norm was complaining about his job again. Today, all the street department laborers had been getting the park ready for the concert. So I'm up at Joey's stand getting some popcorn and a Coke, and Green drives up, and he leaps out of the car and grabs me by the shirt, and he says, I'm docking you a half hour for this, Fermoyle. Norm looked at her now. The guy's nuts! The phone rang, and she jumped so fast to answer it that she was sure they were watching, pitying her for caring so much when Omar Duval obviously cared so little. If it's Lester, I'm not here, Alice called as she tied her A+X apron.
If he gets on my back one more time, I'm quitting, Norm was saying, and if he lays one more hand on me, I swear, I'll deck him.
I'm sorry, Les, she's not here, she said tersely, her eyes closed. Alice had told her how Lester had acted the other night, and yet she couldn't help feeling sorry for him.
Would you have her call me when she gets home tonight, Mrs. Fermoyle? It's important.
Yes, I'll tell her, Les, she said, forcing control into her voice when it was all she could do to keep from screaming. When she turned, they were eating pudding. Pudding, she thought. Pudding, she felt like screaming. How could they sit there eating pudding when she was going to pieces right before their very eyes?
You should see what Green did to poor Joey's stand, Norm was telling them. He got 2x4s and just nailed them on the sides from the ground to the roof, like a jail, like bars. Joey's mad as hell.
She was running water to soak the pudding pan. She stared out at the two rakes leaning against the Klubox house. She was tired of being alone. Once, soon after the divorce, she had gone out with a resin salesman from New York. At the end of the night, she had cried all the way home. She had even considered going back to Sam. At least it would be better than being so alone, so desperate, she had reasoned, until the next time Sam had showed up, pounding on the door, demanding to see the kids he wanted to be with only when he was drunk. Norm had gotten up from the table to stand next to her. He put his hand on her shoulder.
Mom, he said softly, don't feel bad about that creep Duval, okay? Believe me, the guy's a bum.
She turned stiffly, eyes widening.
Don't you, of all people, call anyone a bum. You with your fights and all your belly aching about your job.
He held up his hands as if in surrender.
I'm sorry, all right? I'm sorry, it's just that he's...
He shook his head and turned away.
What? She spun around. He's what? She demanded.
At the table, Benji groaned and looked at Alice, who quickly gathered up the rest of the dirty dishes and brought them to the counter. Benji fled into the living room, where he turned on the television.
You know where he's been all week? Norm asked, trembling. Do you really want to know?
Yes.
No, you don't, Norm said, because then you'd really feel bad.
Her face twisted.
What are you talking about? About Duval and...
and Bernadette Mansaw.
Oh, God, Alice groaned.
Don't be ridiculous, Marie said. Muttering savagely, she turned on the water and started tossing the plates and cups into the sink. Had he been in town all week, living somewhere else? That was worse than if he'd just taken off on her. That doesn't make any sense. He's in Bennington. People in this town, they're all...
Something cracked. She turned off the water and from the suds pulled out a broken plate. She held it up.
See? See what you made me do? Now all I have is four, she said, then started to cry.
I'll do the dishes, Alice said, taking the dripping piece from her.
Come on, Mom, Norm said. He put his arm around her. Go watch TV with Benji.
At that, she pulled away and stormed around the corner, where Benji sat smiling at Queen for a day. She yanked out the plug and sparks flew from the outlet.
You and your goddamn television!
She stood over him. Blood seeped between her fingers. She had cut herself on the plate. Benji kept looking at her hand with a dazed, foolish smile that sickened her.
You're 12 years old, damn it! Don't you have any friends? Why do I have to go to the band concert with you? What's wrong with you?
She demanded, all the while thinking,
What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me?
Mom! Alice called from the sink.
Leave him alone, Norm moaned from the kitchen. He didn't do anything.
She ran back into the kitchen, holding her bleeding hand up by the wrist.
I'll leave him alone, she screamed. I'd like to leave you all the hell alone.
She held her throbbing hand under the running water.
Go ahead, Norm muttered. Do us all a favor. Ever since he came, you've been running around like a chicken with your head cut off. You're either giggling or you're screaming.
She looked at them. She held on to the counter to steady herself.
Who the hell? Mom?
Alice interrupted in a cold voice. Can't you see what a phony he is? She glanced frantically between them. Didn't they understand that her every thought, every plan and dream was for them? Even the way she felt about Omar Duval, it was for them. Her hand bled profusely now. She wrapped it in a towel, certain if she looked, she would see a finger nearly severed.
Selling things from door to door with a bunch of con artists? Alice was saying. That's so...
No,
Marie said. He did his own selling. Those were people he tried to help.
Mom, everything he says is a lie, Norm said. He's like a flim-flam man, like one of those shell game guys at the fair. He gives you a sob story, and the whole time he's with Bernadette Mansaw.
Doesn't that tell you anything, Mom?
Alice said, her voice dropping.
Bernadette Mansaw, Mom? She's my age.
And selling things door to door, Mom. Doesn't that prove anything? Norm said.
It was them against her. She rubbed her hand.
Help me. God, help me.
She was thinking as they watched.
Please help me.
The back door opened then, and Omar's voice oozed over them like soothing ointment. He stood there with a paper bag under his arm.
Yes, Norm, it does prove something.
His eyes gleamed over a bruised smile.
It proves again the frailty, the folly of loving too much, of caring about someone so much that when you try to lead them to higher ground, you are often left with the slop of their sins on your own shoes.
He stepped into the kitchen and laid the bag on the table. The smell of his limey hair pomade filled the room. He laughed bitterly.
But when you've spent your whole life believing and hoping and wanting to help, you don't ask for proof of someone's goodness, for affidavits of someone's worth.
Leaning closer to her, he whispered,
Do you?
He shook his head.
No. You ask for the only truth you've ever needed or known, the word of your fellow man.
His voice trembled, its wounded eloquence fleshing, clothing the words in such credence, breathing into them such wholeness, that this room, the very air, seemed to her filled with an almost holy presence. Watching him, she hugged her bound hand to her chest. He looked back at Norm and Alice then and said sadly,
You know, they were so simple. I made the mistake of thinking of them as children who could be shown, who could be taught, and the very night before they ran off with my goods and my car, I sat them down and told them there were two things I could not endure.
He looked hard at Norm, who was smirking, and Alice, who stared at the floor, and he said,
Dishonesty and sinful lust.
He sighed.
And look where that sermon left me. Plundered.
he whispered.
Deserted.
He looked at Marie.
Alone.
Benji was glad to see Alice and Norm leave. He sat on the front steps waiting for his mother. It was 7:30, and the band concert would be starting soon. He couldn't wait to see the fireworks tonight. His mother's voice sifted through the screens as Omar bandaged her hand. She was happy again, but he knew it wouldn't last. It never did. Just then, Klubok's dog came across the driveway. The dog hunched up and defecated on the one scorched patch of grass that was their lawn. The dog sniffed at its mess, then trotted up to the steps. Benji glanced back at the door. He bent close to the dog and whispered,
"Go on home. Go."
Panting, the dog sat at his feet.
"Go on now, before she sees you,"
he said with a gentle nudge of his foot. The dog waddled off and sat between the two driveways, looking forlornly across at him.
"Go on,"
he said with a stamp of his foot, and the dog got up and started down the street, then disappeared into the woods. He thought of his grandmother behind the bars of her giant crib. His father was locked up somewhere in a place called Applegate, somewhere far away, he hoped, hearing his mother's sudden laughter. He blinked and looked up. Galloping down the street from the woods came the dog, now with something brown and leathery dangling from its mouth.
"Norm's glove," he gasped, chasing after the dog. "Come on! Come here, boy! Come on!"
he begged, zigzagging from lawn to driveway to lawn after the exhilarated dog. Just ahead, the dog paused, waiting. When he got close enough, he reached for the glove, and the dog, its ears pricked back, shot away from him. Benji came down to the road. He could hear the dog trotting at his heels, its nails ticking over the asphalt. Suddenly he whirled around and dove on the dog, and with his arms around its head, managed to twist the catcher's mitt free from its strong, wet jaw. He sat back on his heels, sorrowfully examining the ruined glove. It was not only stiff and cracked and stained, but it smelled so bad that he had to hold his breath. With his stomach turning, he picked up a stick, which he jammed into the glove. He carried it like that to the garage and hung it on a nail just inside the door. In the distance, the band was starting to play. He started into the house to tell his mother, but stopped at the screen door when he saw Omar kissing her. She was up on her tiptoes with her arms around his neck. Omar's back was against the refrigerator, and his eyes were closed. Both of his big hands were open on her rear end. She was making hungry, slurping, groaning sounds. Benji just stood there. He had never seen her kiss anyone before. Omar saw him. He said something, and they pulled apart and both started talking at once. She tugged at her skirt and adjusted her waistband. Her face was red. Benji opened the door and came in. Omar moved quickly to the table and reached into his bag and pulled out a green and pink box. This was the soap America was waiting for, he was intent on telling Benji. It seemed the most important thing anyone had ever said to him. All at once, unmoored, random facts like familiar distant stars suddenly had names along with a stunning realization that they were not just part of a pattern, of a constellation, but before his very eyes had become this great, brilliant meshing of gears, drive shafts, pistons, and pinions that would transport them to happiness. Yes, even Benji could make money selling it, on his bike door to door. Did he have a bike? Well then, with Presto soap, he'd have one in no time. Omar snapped his fingers like the guy who did the vegetable slicer ads on television. So much to tell and sell in 30 seconds. And here, Omar reached into the bag and held up a bottle filled with an orangey-pink liquid. Here, this was its liquid counterpart, a concentrate so powerful one teaspoonful could eat through a ton of rust, a mountain of dirt. His mother stood by the back door with the car keys. It was the cleanser of the future. They'd better go, she said. So versatile, it could shampoo your hair or shampoo your carpet. Benji, she was saying. Depending on the dilution, of course. Benji smiled and couldn't look away. This contained more than soap. There was nothing this product could not do. Omar, she said. As they got out of the car, the band was playing My Grandfather's Clock. The crowd clapped to the tick-tocking beat. Many of them had been camped here since early evening with their picnic hampers and lawn chairs. The sun was just sinking behind the dark mountains. Benji looked breathlessly at the hundreds of young people walking around and around the bandstand, their feet seeming to move in perfect time to the music. Overhead, A bright pinwheel of paper lanterns had been strung from the trees to the gold-leafed weather vane on the bandstand roof. Balloon vendors worked their way through the sea of blankets. Other vendors sold Uncle Sam dolls on sticks and small American flags. A long line of customers waited in front of Joey's popcorn stand. Amid the swirl of music and lights, the lopsided red stand with its stave-like boards looked like some fantastic hot-air contraption that had just floated haphazardly down from the skies and landed on the edge of the park. Inside, Joey's arms were a blur of motion, scooping popcorn from his churning glass popper and passing out the boxes with the grim intensity of one bailing out a sinking boat. Across the street, in front of the armory, the fireworks technicians were setting up their equipment under Robert Haddad's watchful eye. Haddad was chairman of the chamber's pyrotechnic committee. He shifted nervously from foot to foot. His heart ached. Astrid had refused to come tonight. Instead, had gone to a cookout with her girlfriend. Babies cried while others slept hammocked in their mother's cross-legged laps, and high in a large elm tree in the farthest corner of the park were Norm and Weeb with an arsenal of cherry bombs. Jarden Green was going to pay tonight. Marie slipped Omar a dollar to buy ice cream from a boy with a silver cooler strapped to his chest. The three of them came down the path eating peel-away cones as they looked for space to spread their blanket.
"This," said Omar in his booming voice, "is what life is all about. This is America."
People nudged one another and nodded at this tall stranger, conspicuous in his limp white suit and dark shirt. Marie's face drained as they passed the Klubox, who sat in a close circle with three other families, all eating fried chicken and potato salad from red, white, and blue-striped plates.
"Marie!"
Jesse Klubach called out and waved for her to join them, but Marie pretended not to have heard. Ahead, Howard and Josie Amenka were sitting on a bright Afghan. Clutching the strings of their red balloons, they watched in astonishment as Marie and Benji passed with Omar. Marie went on until she came to a section of the park where she recognized no one.
"Lovely night.
Such music.
Excuse me. Wonderful. Hello, my dear."
Omar greeted those nearby as he spread their blanket with a flourish onto the damp ground. The band were dressed in their usual white hats and white jackets, but this night was different from the Sunday night concerts. Tonight they all wore red ties that glistened with silver stars, and tonight their expressions over their instruments were a little less complacent. This was their biggest crowd of the summer. After each number, everyone in the park whistled and clapped and cheered, and as the night shrank up in coolness, the crowd moved closer to one another on their blankets, and they began to sing along with the music. The young people continued walking in their customary circle around the bandstand, the eager clumps of girls in animated conversation, not hearing a word said as their eyes darted from boy to boy. Beside Benji, Omar had begun to sing softly, "Good night, Marie, good night." Benji saw his mother blush and turn away with the dazed, startled look of a starving woman suddenly confronted with a feast. Just then, the first burst of fireworks sizzled into the sky, and three umbrellas of shimmering red, white, and blue lights opened in the night, cascading one after the other as the crowd cheered. Next to the armory was Marco's pharmacy, where Robert Haddad had been standing by the delivery door. He watched Marco and his wife hurry outside to watch the fireworks display from the sidewalk. Without a moment's hesitation, Haddad slipped inside the drugstore. He rang open the register, scooped the bills into his pockets, then slid out the side door, his prayerful litany.
"God helps those who help themselves. God helps those who help themselves,"
pounding in his ears louder than the fusillade of rockets exploding into the night. Sam Vermoyle sank uneasily into the leather chair beside the mahogany desk. A few moments later, the door opened, and Dr. Litchfield hurried into his unlit office.
"Sorry for the delay," he said, closing the Venetian blinds before he sat down.
"That you, Doc?"
he asked, squinting.
"It's me."
Dr. Litchfield chuckled and turned on his lamp. He'd taken a special interest in Sam's case and was himself conducting the therapy ordinarily handled by a team of staff psychiatrists. Litchfield seemed convinced he could save him with what he called his pioneering practice plus treatment program. Sam had been candid in the first few sessions, but now he knew it was the same old bullshit, and no one was better at bullshit than he was. Litchfield leaned back now while Sam lit a cigarette.
"They're mentholated," Litchfield smiled.
I thought you might like those better. Look, Doc, I don't mean to sound ungrateful, he said, shaking out the match, but I've been here 2 weeks today, and I need to go home.
Litchfield smiled gently.
You think you're ready for that, Sam? For your sister? For your ex-wife? For your children? You think you're ready for all that guilt right now? Ready as I'm ever going to be.
He sighed, then leaned over the desk.
My kids need me, Doc. That's the thing. I want to help my kids. I don't know if you want to help them, Sam, so much as you want them to help you.
Litchfield mused, toying with his glass paperweight that had a starfish embedded in it.
There's an enormous amount of work to be done in the area of self-involvement, Sam.
Self-involvement? What the fuck did that mean? He ground his teeth.
Whatever you say, Doc. You're a sensitive man, Sam. I try. But that may be the very root of your crisis. You have borne a lifetime of anxiety and guilt, Sam. You can say that again. And you have accepted these burdens much too readily and without question.
Sam nodded.
I know.
He didn't know how many more of these sessions he could stand. He wanted a drink. Litchfield's voice buzzed like a persistent fly in the room as he paced back and forth. Sam had stopped listening. Litchfield turned abruptly.
You have to learn how to forget the past and focus on what is real, Sam, on what is real to you,
he pointed,
even if all the world does think it's a lie. For isn't much of life a lie, Sam?
He cocked his head, waiting for an answer. Sam gripped the arm of the chair. He'd kill right now for a drink. Litchfield hurried to his side and bent over him.
What I'm asking is, are you an alcoholic, or...
He peered into Sam's blinking eyes and whispered,
is it just that you cannot drink moderately? Which is real, Sam? What others say about you or what you believe about yourself? Sam, you've got to search out your own reality, your very own singular meaning, and that will be all the peace you'll ever need. That's all the peace any of us need.
Sam glanced at Litchfield's wristwatch. 20 more minutes of this bullshit. He was tired.
I have no meaning, Doc,
he sighed.
And about all the reality I could handle right now is in a bottle somewhere.
Litchfield clutched his arm.
Don't you see? You sit here before me. I touch you. You feel my touch. Right now, that's all you need of reality. It's the beginning. You're not real because I'm telling you I'm touching you. You're real because you can feel my hand on your arm.
Sam's stomach growled with hunger. Lunch was still an hour away. Food had become the most important event here. Last night he had awakened throbbing with desire from a dream of fat pink shrimp stuffed with buttery crumbs. Maybe Litchfield was trying to make him think he was crazy so that when his 30 days were up, he'd be begging to stay here forever. Where was the money coming from for this? Why the hell was Helen paying to keep him here when she could have had him admitted to the state hospital for nothing? It made no sense. He had written her 3 letters asking why. She hadn't answered any of them. $70 a day times 30 days, $2,100. Jesus Christ, what had Litchfield promised her? For that kind of money, he must have guaranteed her a cure. No, he thought, for $2,100 he must have promised to remove him from her life forever. He stared at Litchfield, who was pacing between the window and the desk, his arms jabbing the air, his cheeks flushed with heat. His voice sputtered and hissed with such passion that he seemed unaware of the lisp that crept into his speech.
And so you must not judge yourself too harshly, Samuel. As these sessions go on, your understanding of the real you will grow, and you will cease being Samuel Formoyle, the chronic alcoholic. You will become Samuel Formoyle, the man caught in an existential vacuum, a very 20th century man struggling from the hell of what other people tell him he is, back into the path of what he knoweth he must become for his own singular being and reality.
He lifted Sam's hand, sandwiching it between his own.
Thit,
Sam said, and pulled his hand away. Litchfield flinched as if an old scab had just been gouged. He busied himself with the papers on his desk. When he looked up, his face was drained, his eyes arid and clinical.
Your cruelty, Mr. Formoyle, is just like your drinking. Another form of self-destruction, that's all.
Litchfield's jaw trembled. Sam looked down at his hands and squirmed, his legs damp against the leather chair. Thirst scorched the inside of his mouth. They wouldn't even let him keep shaving lotion in his room. Marie used to hide the vanilla extract and the cough syrup and the can openers and his money and his car keys and, on Saturday nights, his shoes. She was always trying to stay a step ahead of him, running with the ferocious tenacity of a child racing water buckets between the ocean and the forever draining hole she had scraped in the sand. His mother had hidden nothing from him, not love, not money, not sorrow. She had nourished him on the catafalque of her sorrow, her disappointment in his father, in him, absolving him with tears until the morning after Alice's birth, when she had plucked him from her life without so much as a catch in her voice. There would be no more denial, she had told him, no more excuses, and then the key had turned in the lock. He looked up meekly and cleared his throat. He had nipped at the hands that could release him. He apologized. Litchfield answered softly, gently.
We will polarize your tension and your distress, Sam. We will teach you that they can be very necessary components in an emotionally healthy life. We will take your sadness and your tears, and we will learn to savor them, to find meaning for them. I will give you the will to live again. Look at me, Sam. Do you understand what I'm trying to tell you?
Sam nodded. Litchfield put a box of tissues in front of him and smiled.
I'm very tired now, Dr. Litchfield, he said, blowing his nose.
He had to get the hell out of here.
I'd like to go back to my room and just lay there and think this all through.
Litchfield squatted down, disappearing behind his desk. Sam waited. He heard a drawer slide open. Litchfield's head popped up level with the desktop. His chin rested on the edge, and he smiled across at Sam.
I've got a little surprise here, he teased,
then ducked down again. One by one they appeared on the desk, a cut-glass decanter of shimmering golden whiskey, a pair of shot glasses small as thimbles. Instinctively, Sam's body drew forward. He could taste it. He could smell it. He arched back stiffly in the chair. Litchfield was looking in his closet now.
Here we go, he said,
returning to his chair with a plate of Ritz crackers and a pressurized can of cheese spray. Pursing his lips as he sprayed a dainty cheddar bud atop each cracker, he told Sam that whiskey was one of the oldest medicines known to man, and, if used properly, it could be an art form, an elegant ritual between two gentlemen. He offered Sam the crackers.
This is a closely guarded secret, my new therapy,
Litchfield said between nibbles.
I've applied for a grant. You see, I'm trying to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt to my skeptical peers that some men are not just alcoholics, quote-unquote, but victims of opinion, victims of labels, if you will, labels pasted on their foreheads sometimes as early as birth. Labels that say such ridiculous things as, your father was an alcoholic, your grandfather was an alcoholic, old Uncle Jim is an alcoholic. It runs in the family. It's in our blood.
Litchfield wagged his finger and deepened his voice.
Therefore, don't drink, or you will be an alcoholic too.
He laughed lightly and popped another cracker into his mouth.
So, what was the first thing you did when you got old enough?
His eyes bulged toward the decanter. He didn't answer. Litchfield raised the decanter in both hands.
You sneaked a drink, right?
His grin rippled through the amber liquid.
Out behind the proverbial barn, right, Sam?
Behind the furnace in high school after a baseball game.
Sam gulped and closed his eyes.
Can I have a drink, Doc?
Litchfield placed the decanter in front of him.
In just a minute. After you understand what I'm trying to do.
He hunched eagerly on his elbows.
I'm going to teach you how to taste, how to swallow, how to drink, and the key here will be control, a little bit at a time. When we're done, Sam, you are going to be able to drink socially, like a gentleman, not guiltily, not furtively, but right out in the open, one drink, maybe two, after a lot of therapy, of course, but never, never more than that. Control, Sam. That's the key here. Control.
By the time the glasses were finally filled, Sam was in a cold sweat. His hand jerked across the desk, but Litchfield pushed it back. He shook his head.
No, Sam, relax. Let it sit there a while. Close your eyes. There's no hurry. We're having a lovely little talk here, just you and me. It's been a long day.
Litchfield dimmed the lamp.
Picture it now. We're in a small cafe outside of town, about to have a leisurely drink before we drive home to the wife and the kiddos.
Litchfield's fuzzy voice droned at his ears. He ground his teeth until they ached.
Go ahead now. Open your eyes. Casually place your hand around the glass, each finger closing one by one so you can savor the moment, the anticipation that is probably more pleasurable than the actual act. Now raise it. Slowly, slowly to your lips. That's it. There's no hurry, no rush. It's only tea,
he cried, spitting it out.
Weak tea! Christ!
Litchfield pounded his fist down on the desk.
I was about to tell you that, but you couldn't wait.
Stunned, he watched Litchfield refill the glass, then calmly raise his own. He stood up and stalked toward the door.
I'm through playing games, you asshole!
He yelled, suddenly sickened by the desperate pitch of his own shrill voice. Tonight was Alice's turn in the far end of the A+X lot, which was considered the worst station because it only got busy when the rest of the lot was full. But for Alice, its worst feature was the nearness to the bright kitchen doorway, where Anthology Carper lounged between orders, his short legs dangling from the tall metal stool, a cigarette burning between his gray teeth, his colorless eyes trailing her every move. It was the Monsignor's long black Oldsmobile with Father Gannon at the wheel, and beside him Father Krestecki, a pale, skinny priest with big ears. Father Krestecki had been at St. Mary's a few years ago, but Alice had only ever talked to him in the confessional. He had been a popular confessor, his most common penance the exhortation to be kind.
Hello, Alice,
Father Gannon said, sticking his hand out the window to shake hers.
This is Father Krestecki.
Father Krestecki reached across Father Gannon and also shook her hand. Nice to meet you, she said, her face flaming. Why were they here? What did they want? Had something happened? Norm? He'd been in an accident. Norm with his rage and lately all his drinking. No, Omar had the car again tonight. Maybe that was it. Maybe Omar Duval had smashed into a tree and died. God, what a relief that would be.
Father Krestecki used to be at St. Mary's. Until he got called up to the majors,
Father Gannon added, his sudden pronged laughter jolting up her spine. She nodded, managing a smile.
I'd hardly call St. D's the majors, said Father Krestecki. Well, being past us certainly is.
Again, Father Gannon's laugh seemed forced and unnatural.
Oh, well, I don't know about that,
Father Krestecki demurred.
He's very modest, isn't he? For the youngest pastor in the diocese.
You're really embarrassing me, Father Krestecki said softly. Father Gannon smiled up at her, and her face grew redder. Could I take your order, please? She asked.
Two root beer floats, he said, still smiling.
While she was clamping their tray onto the car door, a pickup truck peeled out of the lot. Father Gannon craned his neck to watch it speed up the highway.
This must be a great place to work, he said, rubbing his hands together. All this action, all this life.
A bit too lively for me, I'm afraid, Father Krestecki said between slurps. Father Gannon had yet to take a sip of his float.
By the way, what are your hours?
He asked. 4 to 12, she said, sliding her pencil over her ear. A car was pulling in next to the priest's, and now another. The movie must be getting out. The lot was almost full.
12, Father Gannon said with a glance at his watch. Long day.
As she walked away, she could see his reflection in the tall, angled sheets of tinted glass. He was watching her and smiling. At midnight, Blue Mooney was in the kitchen eating hot dogs while his cousin scraped the grills clean and drained the fryolators. Alice watched for Norm by the side of the road so Mooney wouldn't see that she was still here. He had offered her a ride home again tonight, and Anthology Carper had hissed under his breath, No thanks, scum. I'd rather crawl than be seen with you. The office telephone was ringing. Coughlin opened his door and called out that her brother said to start walking. The car still wasn't back. That could only mean Omar Duval hadn't brought it back yet. Lately he drove it so much that he was picking her mother up in the morning and dropping her off at work. Alice didn't mind as much as Norm, who couldn't believe any of this was happening. The minute Mooney and Carper came out of the kitchen, she hurried up Main Street. The tips in her sagging pockets jingled and banged against her leg. Behind her, the headlights of a slowing car flicked three times from high to low beams, each with a soft tap of the horn. She walked faster.
"Alice!"
called a voice, and she groaned. After that night at the lake, Mooney was never going to leave her alone. He would hound her forever, because now he knew who she was and what she was, and soon everyone would know. She was almost running when the car pulled alongside.
"Alice, wait! Want a ride?"
It was Father Gannon. He said he'd just dropped off Father Christecki in Proctor. She accepted gratefully when she saw Blue Mooney's car roar out of the lot. At home, the driveway was empty. She wanted to get inside before Omar Duval arrived in her mother's car, before she had to explain or lie or, worse, introduce the two men. Father Gannon kept initiating new conversations that fizzled into throat clearing and now just the uneasy tap of his nails on the steering wheel.
"Well, thank you for the ride," she said, starting to open the door.
"Alice, there's just one thing," he said with such
startling intensity that his voice trembled and his cheeks flushed.
"You know, this wasn't a coincidence, my coming to the A plus X tonight."
He blinked and clenched his fists.
"I didn't want to say anything in front of Father Christecki, but Saturday I have to drive up to Burlington to take some papers to the bishop. Applegate's on the way, and if you felt like it, I could drop you off there to see your father, then pick you up on the way back. So what do you think?"
"No, I can't," she said quickly.
She couldn't recall any nun or priest ever embarrassing her about her father until this insensitive, nosy priest. Her mother would have a fit.
"He'd like to see you," Father Gannon said softly. "You know, this is when he needs his family most."
2 weeks ago, she had written her father a letter, which he still hadn't answered. She had been careful to write only of cheerful, funny things. Norm washing the car's engine until it gleamed, but then wouldn't start because all the water had flooded it. The afternoon when Benji fell asleep at the movies until 6 at night. When they called the theater and an usher found him and woke him up. Her job, which she had tried to make sound interesting, the robbery at Marco's pharmacy. "I miss you," she had written, "and I hope you're feeling much better." "He never writes unless he wants something," her mother had said yesterday as she came in empty-handed from the mailbox.
"The Monsignor got this letter from your father this morning,"
Father Gannon said, handing her an envelope.
"He says he misses his children dearly. He'd like to see you."
She turned it over, then looked up blankly.
"It's all right. Go ahead and read it. The Monsignor gave it to me. I answered it, and he signed it. That's what's meant by religious hierarchy,"
he said, laughing. J.M.J. "Dear Monsignor, it is difficult for me to write this letter in view of these bleak facts. I am, 1, a prisoner here, 2, a mental patient, and thus, 3, not to be taken seriously, and 4, without much hope of a near release from this expensive hellhole, unless you intercede on my behalf, as I, your faithful parishioner, have implored you to do in my previous unanswered letters. I am writing this letter in order to humbly ask your forgiveness for the events preceding my internment here. If, as I suspect, I embarrassed or insulted you or yours in any way, I am sincerely and most soberly contrite. There are some inevitable events in a man's life over which he has little or no control. In my own, I am all the events. Beyond that, I offer no excuses but my own pitiless state of being, or non-being, whichever your viewpoint. Again, my plea is the same. Please see my dear sister and convince her that she must get me out of here. 1, this is a godless place. They tinker with our minds and care not for our souls. 2, the rates are exorbitant. $70 a day, special treatments extra. Where will that money come from? 3, I cannot exist much longer without seeing my children. They are all that I live for. Please speak to Helen. Tell her I wither here without the solace of my church and family. I want to receive communion, but I am denied sacraments. Helen would be much better off giving her money to you than to this bunch of fat cat Protestants. For what she pays here, the Pope would say a special mass for her, I'm sure. Thank you, Monsignor. Please pray for me if you get the chance. Sincerely yours in Christ, Samuel A. Fermoyle. Postscript. Bubbles, you still have not sent that letter to Dr. Litchfield attesting to my sanity. Just as surely as you know I am not insane, know that I will do the same for you if your bishop should ever decide to farm you out. S.A.F. She folded the letter, stunned that he would write to the Monsignor, but not to his own daughter.
I mailed a letter back tonight, Father Gannon was saying. On my way up to the A plus X, as a matter of fact.
Pausing, he leaned toward her.
Are you all right? The letter, it didn't upset you, did it? Oh, listen to me. Of course it did. I mean, this must be all so painful for you. Believe me, I know it is. And I also know how personal this is. Alice, believe me, this is so confidential it's sacred. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, this is the same as being in the confessional together.
What did you say to him in your letter? What did you write? She asked, rubbing her eyes.
The last thing she wanted to do was cry. She pretended to yawn. Oh, let's see. It was a long letter. I told him so many things. To keep the faith and pray and cooperate with the doctors and that God would help him. That his children stood by him, that...
He stopped, shocked by what he had just heard. His face reddened.
What did you say?
Nothing. She covered her mouth. She couldn't believe she'd said that. It had slipped out.
You called me an asshole, didn't you?
No.
I heard you.
He looked every bit as shocked as she was. I said the word, but I didn't mean to. It just slipped out.
I'm such an inspiration, he said.
I'm sorry, she said. I'm so embarrassed.
Don't be. I've been called worst, he said, trying to laugh.
I didn't mean you, she said, desperate for a way out of this mess. You see, I'd go with you to see my father, but I know it would really make my mother mad. She's...
No, no. As a matter of fact, she said she thought it was a good idea. She said you'd be the best one to go.
You already talked to my mother about this? She asked, stunned.
Well, I called her.
And when did she say I could go?
Next weekend. That's when I have to go up.
What time did she say you should pick me up?
Well, she didn't really say, but after I leave the nursing home. 10?
And what time would we get back?
She said you have to be at work by 4.
Of course, she said with a bitter sigh. She wouldn't want me to miss work.
It'd be just the boost he needs, he said as she got out of the car. You'd be so glad you did it.
Klubach's dog was sitting by the back steps with a long rag dangling from its mouth. The dog stood and wiggled its rump, but she opened the back door quickly. My God, you stink! Go on, she hissed, stamping her foot. Get out of here! Hoping to shorten his stay, Sam Fermoyle was trying his best to relax and become more a part of the Applegate routine. He made up his mind to participate in the group therapy sessions he had been sitting through mutely. He would become the perfect patient. The nurses noticed the change. They brought him magazines from the staff lounge and extra cigarettes. The maids in their navy blue uniforms and white ruffled aprons took twice as long to clean his room. One of them, an olive-skinned stout woman from town, made him guanti and smuggled it into his room.
Men who drink need a lot of sugar, she told him as she watched him eat.
The powdered sugar fell like fine snow onto the green bedspread. She brushed it off.
I'm through with drinking, he said hoarsely.
You should be, she said, handing him a napkin. A man with a silver tongue like you should be out making $1 million for himself, like my son.
Though Litchfield wouldn't tell Sam exactly when he'd be leaving, he had begun to make plans. When he got home, he was going to get a job. Not just any job this time, but one he could look forward to when he got up in the morning, one he could be proud of. He would move out of Helen's and get his own place. Yesterday he had written Helen a letter asking her to send the want ads from the Atkinson Crier. He would have to get new clothes. He had made up a list of what he'd need for work. 2 pairs of shoes, 1 black, 1 brown, 3 white shirts, 3 ties, blue, red, and brown, 2 suits, gray and brown, 7 pairs of socks, 7 sets of underwear, handkerchiefs. He had started a grocery list, but only got as far as coffee and sugar. He didn't know if his room would have a refrigerator for the cream, or even a stove, for that matter. And where would this room be? Who would rent him a room if he didn't have a job? And who the hell was going to hire him? And if no one would hire him, how the hell was he going to pay for the new clothes? And if he didn't have at least 1 good suit and a pair of half-decent shoes, he couldn't even hold his head up during an interview. He would write Helen another letter asking for a loan to get him started. He stood in front of the mirror, combing his hair. He changed his part from right to left, then back again. His first day home, he would get a haircut and a shave. He would ask the barber which side looked best parted. He leaned close to the mirror. He would have those nostril hairs clipped. He felt better already. He started another list. This one, personal care items. Shaving cream, styptic pencil, razors.
Bay rum, he wrote,
then scratched it out with a chuckle. Marie whipped the potatoes, then set the table quickly around Omar,